Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much in the way you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you for your rambling on here tonight with your disclaimer, which is greatly appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to share with you that tonight's going to be a very special call. John has said that he will be here tonight, and we're going to play Moot Court. I don't know if you know what that means, but I get to be a defendant, and he gets to be the judge, and we're going to play back and forth audibly so that you can get a feel how this is so important in litigations, both past, present, and possibly future for you. We do have a first-time caller tonight from Strongsville, Ohio, ending in 0292. May I have your first name only, please?
Yeah, Doug.
Hey, Doug. How'd you hear about us?
How you doing? Oh, I've known about you for a while through Paul.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Welcome to the call. And let me mute you back up here. We also have tonight, golly gee, GW. He's joining us. He must have heard about it. And Raven's here. These are information providers, ladies and gentlemen, that all support the law with regards to identifying you properly upon the land. Now, I want to give you a quick quote. Did I drop it all? Oh, heck, I lost it. I got to go back and get it. Give me one second here. Just take a moment. This is from the Supreme Court of the United States in 1901. This was something that a justice wrote, and I think that you ought to hear it again. We've talked about it a few times. Give me just one moment. Scrolling through. Do I find my pretty red letters? Almost. There it is. This is Downs versus Bidwell. This is one of the Supreme Court cases that defined the words United States. As Downs Bidwell was repeated again, the definition of the United States was repeated again in 1945 in what is known as the Hooven decision. This is a dissenting opinion from Justice John Marshall Harlan, in which he has predicted, frankly, everything that's occurred in American jurisprudence. And when you hear it from him and then how it ties in, it perhaps will make some sense. Quote, "The idea prevails with some, indeed it has found expression in arguments at the bar, that we have in this country substantially two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all the restrictions, the other to be maintained by the Congress outside and independently of that instrument. And now listen to this. By exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to. It continues. I take leave to say that if the principles thus announced should ever receive the sanction of a majority of this court, a radical and mischievous change in our system of government will result. We will, in that event, pass from the era of constitutional liberty, guarded and protected by a written constitution, into an era of legislative absolutism. It will be an evil day for the American liberty if the theory of government outside the Supreme Court, supreme law of the land, finds judgment in our constitutional jurisprudence. No higher duty rests upon this court than to exert its full authority to prevent all violations of the principles of the Constitution. Gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could have a judge like that today? The result of this opinion is a legislature that passes laws actually for two separate countries. They just don't expose which one they're in session for when they're giving their session. They don't say which one they're attending to. The intent is to fool the American people into believing they have jurisdiction where they actually do not have jurisdiction. And it's just about the money. Money, 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 money. What does it mean, quote, by exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to, end quote? Well, consider the name of the essay that I assembled from the writings of a dozen or so men and women, and I've titled it Once We Were Colonists, Subject to a King. Yep. These poor folks are right back in the same place their grandfathers were. No difference. Whereas before, the king was sovereign over the land herein, the Congress is sovereign over the land. And whereas the king was sovereign over the people herein, the Congress is sovereign over the people. Now bear in mind, this is the land of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. 10 miles within the seat of power, all territories, possessions, and enclaves. Now, if you remember from the other court cases that we talked about, one of the court cases stated, and let's see if I can find it real quickly here, so I don't take up too much of your time when we go through it. Let's see. We want to bring this one up. Almost there. Well, I don't find it real quick, and I don't, let me just throw it off the top of my head, and maybe GW will jump in and say, oh, no, you're talking about this. It's where it says that the government is brought into the several states of the Union by the people tapping into a particular agency, that the agencies of the government can establish jurisdictions within the several states. Also, of course, if you use a thing like a zip code, if you have an address, if you claim to be a resident, all these things tie you into the federal government. For instance, I live here in Florida. Florida is, of course, one of the several states of the Union. But is the state of Florida one of the several states of the Union? Did the Buck Act of 1940 allow the government, with the Social Security Act and all the other things that all clustered around 1933 to 1940, bring us to a place where you voluntarily joined, if you would, the United States? It says that the taxes are voluntary. Is it voluntary that you volunteered into the system by exercising certain tools of the United States? I think so. That's where it's voluntary. Once you've committed into it, once you've contracted into it, it's no longer voluntary. You've contracted. You're under the rule of law now. So that piece about it being voluntary is specific to the fact that you messed up when you volunteered to become a United States citizen, whereas by your natural birthright, you are an American national or a Union State citizen. All right, let's see if John has arrived yet. We'll be here. Not yet. Okay. So what I had said earlier at the beginning of this call is we're going to have a moot court tonight, and it's going to be really fun. It will be kind of like if you're old enough to remember Jane Curtin and on Saturday Night Live with Dan Aykroyd when they would debate. Well, let's not go there. We have ladies present. It was fun, though. It was back when Saturday Night Live was actually funny. Back in the day. So, yeah, right. You remember that? You're old enough, huh?
Sure.
Do you remember that case I'm talking about? Where it says that the it's wait a minute. I know where it is.
Oh, good, because I don't.
Oh, come on. Oh, bear in mind, ladies, pardon the silence, and gentlemen. No. Well, oh well. Anyways, so GW, while we're waiting for brother John to show up tonight, would you like to share with us anything?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just relaxing outside, watching the turbulent skies. I love them this way. Here in monsoon season. Here in the Phoenix area, so and I can't really I've had half a dozen conversations today, the one thing that kind of sticks out to me today that's kind of funny is there was a certain site that somebody I was interviewed on, and anyway, there was a lot of comments because this site got thousands of views, and what was interesting is all of the this one gentleman that was talking to me earlier this morning was talking about all the comments from multiple people that were just stirring absolute fear up with people, you know, posting that, oh, you're going to go to jail. You're going to get in so much trouble. You're going to go, this is total BS. This is, you know, cause we were talking about, correcting status. And this guy went on and on and on about all these comments. And I said, you know, and I had actually gone to the site and actually, and I don't do this often because, when people are skeptical and they ask questions about things in a skeptical way and they don't quite understand, that's one thing. But you've got so many people that are just mockers, okay? And they say things and they put out no evidence. And I was, I said, did you read the pro comments about this where it said, hey, GW spot on. I corrected my status back in whenever, and I, you know, I mean, did you read the positive comments, or are you just going after the negative comments where they literally these people never put up any evidence? They never put up the evidence to their skepticism, laws or cases or sightings or anything like that. And so that's the only thing I can add in. I just thought that was hilarious because I, You know, again, I'll say this, because I love Scripture. I love the Word of God. And, it, you know, again, in Scripture, the reason I don't pay attention to a lot of the minutia of comments is because in Scripture, in Proverbs, it says, correct a mocker, okay, and that means you're actually going to try to tell them the truth or correct their statements. It says, correct a mocker and he shall hate you. I think that goes for a woman, too.
Right.
Not only he, right, I think
I found it.
Okay, good.
City of, I appreciate the stall, the distraction. City of Dallas versus Mitchell, 245 Southwest 944, quote, the rights of the individuals, didn't say privileges, it said the rights of the individuals are restricted only to the extent that they have been voluntarily surrendered by the, quote, citizenship, end quote, to the agencies of government.
Wow.
So when you talk about voluntary taxes are voluntary, yes, they are. But once you surrendered by citizenship to these agencies, you're now contracted. You made a contract.
Yeah.
And that is enforceable. What do you say about that, CW?
Yeah, I love it. That is pretty clear, and it should be to the average student, you know, that's coming on the line here and is studying this. It should be clear to them also, and to really understand that they give it up only to the extent where they, you know, read that part again, Michael.
Okay. I got to go back and find it. City of Dallas versus. Sorry?
Go ahead.
City of Dallas versus Mitchell, 245 yes. Southwest, 944, quote, the rights of the individuals are restricted only to the extent that they have been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship to the agencies of government.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And let's just think about this, folks. Where do all these agencies of government operate from? The Constitution, or on the other side, where you have the 50 titles of the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulation, all of your agencies operate out of and through the 50 titles. And we're talking about 500 different agencies, too, that operate within that structure, just 50 titles. Those are only applicable to a certain citizenship, and it's called U.S. citizen, United States citizen, U.S. person, blah, blah, blah. Not a national that has their God-given constitutional rights intact and knows it, by the way, and has put it on the record and it can stand on it. So,
yeah. So that nobody has a knee-jerk reaction. If there's other, you listed others other than United States citizen, you listed, I think, three or four other. One of them was resident. What was the other three?
Yep. Yeah, so there's United States citizen, U.S. citizen, U.S. person, U.S. individual, and the last one, resident. Just bare naked resident.
All of those except for the first one. No. Only the first one is what I meant to say. Is challengeable. A United States citizen, you could argue, not U.S. citizen, not U.S. person, or the others, or resident. You can't argue those because they are what they are. But United States citizen, again, we go back to Black's Law Dictionary, 4th, 5th, and 6th edition. You got Hooven in 1945, Bidwell in 1901. There's three definitions of United States. So when you're talking about United States land or United States people, you've got three possible definitions to work through. So,
yes, you are absolutely, you know, Michael, you're on that. You're absolutely correct. And I want to, you know, I want to first to say you've got that down. But where I really try to help people to get just down to the nitty gritty is that there's when you classify yourself as a national or a state citizen, okay, and you're not even inserting that. I mean, and you, by the way, you can argue it well if you're somebody like Michael, okay, or if your brother John, you can argue it real well. So, and that might be something you want to take on. I just like to categorize it and leave it under, you know, how they do it under the presumption of law. They just leave it right there that, you know, those are, even a United States citizen is one of their property and franchise. And so,
right.
But you're right.
Okay. John has joined us. Welcome, John.
Good evening, gentlemen, ladies.
Good evening to you. We've had some fun here. We have a question real quick from Ed, and then we'll go on to playing around tonight. Go ahead, Ed.
Not in the broad categories of the citizen of the United States, some of the other things mentioned already. That's the main one. But when you cede your rights to one of the agencies, Are we most of the time talking about executive agency coming against you because they got a presumption that you're a U.S. citizen, and you go to court to fight them with your lawyers and stuff like that, and often enough that's considered making a contract with the court and ceding rights away? And a hundred other different things too.
Right. Let me interject here, Ed, if I may, real quickly.
Yeah.
If you've hired a lawyer,
yeah, I understand.
Then you have. I know, but the people on the call may not.
Yeah.
If you hire a lawyer, first place is that you have admitted to the court that you have diminished mental capacity. You're either considered an infant, or someone older with Alzheimer's, or just somebody with brain damage. And you give power of attorney to this attorney to represent you. And once you do that, if any inalienable, unalienable rights that you had are thrown out the window by the mere fact that you hired an attorney. So those are the things that you become a ward of the court. That's the term I was reaching for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Listen, we got people raising their hands. I'm going to stop with Ed right now. Jennifer, we're going to come back because we're going to go into the part of the call tonight that I'm going to unraise your hands from my end. Okay. And when we get to Q&A, you can come back on with your hands. Okay. So, Brother John, we talked earlier today about playing a little moot court, and you wanted to be the judge, right?
Okay. Actually, could I bring something else up?
Help yourself. Come on.
To the
please.
Okay. This is germane to the question that was at hand just moments ago. To that end, right now, I've got a couple of students that were in the process of changing. One of them is before a U.S. District Court judge and he's being prosecuted federally. And the judge, illegally against the Sixth Amendment rights, has demanded that he have an attorney, and he's appointed one, and it was literally on the diminished capacity point that he assigned him counsel. And what happened was that he's forced him to get an attorney, and this was brought to my attention when the student came to me that and so what's happening is instead of writing a power of attorney, I'm in the process of drafting a power of fiduciary. which means that the attorney, in the acting as a fiduciary, cannot, as it were, sell you down the road. And if he does
right.
anything that contributes to a difficulty with you, and this is something that Justice Breshears, Michael, and I have talked about a teensy-weensy little bit in the past, and it was actually something that they bought up to me, and I've been working on implementing that. And so when you sign up for an attorney, it's quite possible that shortly we may have a better document to share with that attorney, where it's not exactly, you're not exactly signing a power of attorney, but you're signing a, you're arranging a contract with power of fiduciary, which the one, the two that have already, one of them commented that says, and the way I wrote that one, I wouldn't write it that way again. I've learned too much since then. It's only been a couple of weeks. Actually, both the ones that I've already written, I wouldn't write it that way again. I've learned so much just in the last couple of weeks. It's amazing. But they both commented that, wait a minute, you know, if he loses, you can come out on top of me because of this contract. And I says, well, maybe, maybe so, maybe not. It depends on how you respond. And I says, we probably won't have any chamber agreements with the prosecutor anymore, at least not on the. And one of them says, you can't do this. I'm going to tear that thing up. I says, no, you can go ahead and tear it up. We've got the original. It would have been interesting to see the look on his face. I almost wish that phone call would have been a Zoom call, because I would have loved to see his face when he said that. But all of a sudden, last week, this gentleman that we arranged this through, this is a gentleman who was my mentor many, many years ago. He's 88 years old, and he's helping this this person on a homeschooling issue in California, and this young family, and this attorney that was bought on under power of fiduciary, is he started acting very differently 2 weeks ago in court once he realized what he had signed. So the power of attorney / power of fiduciary, we're learning that you retain your rights, and we've been studying this, and we're trying to write them so you do retain all of your rights. There's no legal incapacity or disability acknowledged, and there have been cases, and I've been at the bench before when the prosecutor and the defense attorney says, well, okay, I'll let you have this one, and but you owe me one in the future. They've made deals like that, and I've actually been present in judges' chambers when two deals like that were made, and were quite unbeknownst to the defendant. They sold them down and the judge was completely aware of it. So, in advance. So, with that, let's continue on to, we're going to do some role playing here.
John. Did you include within this latest document that you've generated the fact that as an American national, the defendant in error is exercising his right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment?
Actually, we did not. This husband and wife, they're he's 25, she's 23, and they're just starting that walk, and they are incredibly trepid about anything right now that about sovereignty, etc. Her father went to jail and died in jail, quote unquote, defending his rights. She's a little traumatized by it right now. So we're working at getting her past that before we go to that level.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that that should be an absolute portion for anyone who has corrected their status. And just to make certain for everybody with GW here, correcting your status is not the State Department's passport or pass card. That's possibly the fruit of it. But the correction of your status is done with the affidavit. Simple one-page affidavit. Boom. And that applying that to any litigation or any contract just blows everything out of the water. John, Your Honor, I'm a defendant in error here. And the prosecutor has charged me with XYZ, blah, blah, blah. And I'm here to plead guilty or not guilty on this first hearing, supposedly. But I have written the prosecutor asking for the nature and the cause of the charges against me. Specifically, what is the land jurisdiction I am alleged to have committed this crime, and what is the personam jurisdiction that this state acknowledges? And so far to this date, the state has not responded, calling my questions frivolous. If we look at the Articles of Confederation, when we first translated from colonists to state citizens, there was no federal government. And for the next 6 years, give or take, we operated as free men and free women on land that we could hold in allodium. We were co-sovereign with each other. 6 years later, there was the founding fathers met and renamed our Articles of Confederation to a Constitution for the United States of America, and they also included Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 in there where
look,
they
you
defined...
Look, you overly wordy little... I'm going to find you in contempt. Where are you going?
Is that criminal contempt or civil contempt, sir?
I'm going to find you in criminal contempt.
Okay, so
now,
are we going to stop this proceeding right now?
You overly wordy little rat. You cut to the chase.
Who's going to hold a hearing, sir?
You know, and quit putting everybody in my courtroom to sleep.
Nobody's asleep, sir. They're listening with bated breath. They're listening. Because now we've brought up the subject of jurisdiction, and it has been challenged. I'll give you these three court cases here, Your Honor, that says once challenged, you have no option in your capacity other than to hear the matter. Shall we?
So what are you asking?
What I'm asking for, Your Honor, is that the state provides the land jurisdiction and the personam jurisdiction to hear this matter and nothing else. That's what I'm here for.
Okay. Do you know what the word personam jurisdiction means for the term?
I do.
Okay. Explain to me what you think it means.
Well, Your Honor, you're the one here that has findings of facts and conclusions of law. I think it's you that needs to establish it.
You tell me what you
think.
But
personam jurisdiction, Your Honor, it separates the different categories of citizenship. So am I a citizen of the United States? Am I a citizen of one of the several states? Do I have both citizenships? The court has yet, excuse me, not the court, the state has yet to evidence in the record which class of citizenship I am under the Bidwell decision, under the Hooven decision, under Black's Law Dictionary's 4th, 5th, and 6th edition. It's yet to establish it. They refuse to establish it. In Mello versus U.S., quote, once jurisdiction is challenged, the court cannot proceed when it clearly appears that the court lacks jurisdiction. And it clearly the court lacks jurisdiction because the state has not established it. Jurisdiction is established by two parties. It's not been established.
You're here. That's jurisdiction enough for me.
Oh, it is? So are you complicit then with the state in this matter? Is that what you're confessing now on the record?
Okay. Stop tape. Everyone listening, in personam jurisdiction means personal jurisdiction, meaning it has the right over you. And so what's happening is that we're trying to figure out what entity or what set of laws or what set of codes has jurisdiction over the person. And in personam jurisdiction means personal jurisdiction, meaning that it directly affects you. And it's at this juncture, as GW has explained to you and Michael have explained to you, and we've talked about it on previous calls, your status has been colored. And in certain cases, to be able to apply a certain law and certain code and certain statute to you, that status has been colored to allow for that. And claims have been made by the government that because of your status being color, under color, that they have jurisdiction. Now, today, I had almost a 90-minute conference call with the judge just today, and she's been sitting on a bench. She commented that she's been sitting on that bench for 17 and a half years, almost 18 years, the U.S. District Court bench that she sits on, and that in less than an hour, she learned more about personal jurisdiction or in personam jurisdiction in less than an hour than she had learned about in the previous 10 years, and that three times in the last 4 years, pleading was brought to her that was asked, what is the name, contact, address, official position of that, of any person or any plaintiff that there, or that the plaintiff now relies upon or is relied upon who has or can testify that the defendant has elected to become a U.S. citizen? She, at the motion of the prosecution, ruled in favor of the prosecution against the defendant all three times. She commented that, she says, John, I didn't know. I've been on this bench for almost 18 years, and I did not know the gravity of what you just described. And all three times, those people in the last 4 years, there's some guy out in Alabama working with some shyster preacher, she was saying, but she was saying that all, you know, they, she's, that in the words, they're exact same words that you used right there. And she says, how do you deal with that? And I says, well, what would you recommend? She says, you need to educate the prosecutor. And we were talking about a specific case today. And she says, you need to be able to understand. And she says, you've quoted to me many times a saying about you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. And she says, you cannot just ask or make a statement or an objection without the prosecution and most especially the bench knowing what you're talking about. And she says, I guarantee you that of the 93 U.S. District Courts and some of them that have more than 40 judges sitting, just senior justices, magistrates, et cetera, that are, some of them have more than 40. She says, I bet you less than 1% understand what you just described to me about U.S. citizenship today and U.S. citizens and jurisdiction. And she says, you have to be prepared to educate the person that's hearing your case, if it comes to that, because now, knowing what you explained to me today, those other three people, she said, if that question were to come up tomorrow for all three of those people, I would rule in their favor. And instantaneously, she said, I would have dismissed the prosecution or the case against them summarily. But she says, I didn't understand that. And this is a U.S. District Court judge explaining that to me today. So what's happening here is that we need to be prepared to pleasantly, with full respect and kind and deference and consideration to the fact that that person is wearing that gown and handling that gavel to serve the people, regardless of what they were before we came in there. And the same thing for the prosecutor. She emphasized that the prosecutors were the most important and that the discovery package that we were working on for that particular case that she got back to me on finally, she says, you need to use this discovery to educate the prosecutor so that he all of a sudden throws up his hands and says, holy kitty litter, Batman, what we're doing is wrong. I got to dismiss this case. And she says, that way it never gets to my bench or the bench, one of the other benches. She says, if you can educate the prosecutors properly with clear, concise evidence, and I told her that it's funny you should bring that up. I'm working on a brief right now just to do that, exclusively do that. She says, as you work on that, she says, I want to see it. I want to see your work in progress. And she says, we need to make, she says, because I'm going to, she says, I'm going to play the devil's advocate and I'm going to play the judge that's dumb as a box of rocks. And this is the word she's using. And she says, and I'm going to stick it to you and make sure that you can educate me in third grade, English so that, you understand that I either got it or I didn't. And, she kind of dressed me down a little bit today. But I learned a lot today. Today was a very serious, moment of academia, if you will. I realized for those of you who, understand the concept of an intelligent designer or a higher power, or that you may respect the God of the Hebrews and the Christians, the son made a comment. He says, go settle with your adversary on the way to court. Lest, paraphrase, he takes you to the cleaners. Lest the judge hand you over to the jailer and the jailer put you in jail and then you're not released till you've paid your debt in full. Well,
I agree with him quickly.
This bench is not a, shall we say, a completely respected person of the higher power or the intelligent designer. But she made it very clear that the concept was valid and correct. So, something that, a new approach that, well, an approach that I'm about to work on and start starting today improving on is educating the prosecutor through the discovery process to, for those that have already ended up in court and have already been charged. We're going to see about tactfully addressing them and winning them over. There's something that she says to me, she'll know the truth and the truth shall set you free. Well, if we can tactfully with respect win the prosecutor over, then he'll dismiss this before it ever gets to a judge, and then we're off like a herd of turtles. Michael, would you like to go back to the role playing?
Yeah, sure would. Hold on a second here. So, Your Honor, the last thing she said is that you're here and I'm here, and therefore you have jurisdiction. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
You know why I asked? Would you like
Hagen
to know
versus
why?
Levine.
You just put words in my mouth. That's unsanitary. But you know, would you like to know why I phrased it just that way? Young man?
Sure.
Because I don't think you know I don't think you know what jurisdiction is, and I don't, and right now I don't think you understand what you're saying or what you're asking for. So I'm going to ask you to spell it out. And if you can convince me you know what it is and that this court doesn't, then I might rule in your favor. So,
sure.
You were getting a little wordy there. You got 3 minutes. Go.
I don't need 3 minutes. Higgins versus Levine, 415 U.S. 533, Your Honor. Quote, the law requires proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the agency and its proceedings. End quote. I've asked for it to be presented on the record by the state. The state brushes me off. Would you please compel the prosecutor to establish on the record proof of jurisdiction, both land and personam?
Now, okay, we were in a case about a year and a half ago where you forgot Downs versus Bidwell too, but there's a few others there. In where we did not educate the whole court at the same time, they ruled against the jurisdiction and struck it down. And the question of jurisdiction was raised four times in written pleadings and three times verbally for a total of seven times. And because the individual could not explain the jurisdictional issue, the prosecutor, having two PhDs in jurisprudence, one in criminal law, one in constitutional law, she very quickly pulled out some statutes and some case law, quoted against it, and the judge, without even looking it up, ruled against the defendant. Okay. If you have to educate the court, you need to do it as candidly and as succinctly as possible. And if you refer to a case law or a statute, always, always, always quote the verse. You don't have to quote the whole chapter or paragraph, but at least quote the verse that you're speaking to in that specific case law or in the statute. It's very, very important that in all of these cases, you will be pleading your case before a jury. The prosecutor and the judge, even if they don't understand it, if you bring it up and you quote it in the courtroom, most of those jurors a lot of times take notes. But if they don't take notes, if you have a handout to share that explains or that quotes the statute and you ask the question, well, this statute right here or this, the Articles of Confederation gave us that, and you say, what does that mean in this situation? You know, and you ask the question of the, in court, of the prosecutor or the bench, and they'll say, look, I'm not here to give you legal advice. Well, that's a good answer. Thank you. Here it states this, emphatically, and here's a copy for the jury. And you hand it to the bailiff, and you make sure that, and the term for what you're sharing is called judicial notice. You share that with the judge, the prosecutor, and make certain that you have 16 copies. One for the clerk, one for the judge, one for the prosecutor, one for yourself, that's four, and then one each for the 12 jurors. Now I say 16, actually, you always walk into court with 24. Does anybody know why? How many alternate jurors are there?
Yeah.
There's always two, aren't there? Minimum. And at the prosecutor's desk, how many prosecutors are usually there in a felony criminal? There's not usually not just one. A lot of times there's two. So you're going to need plenty to share and go around with, okay? And what will happen is that all your judicial notice, we just counted 16 people up at first, and then we just added four more. So, and then you have to have one. So I recommend 24. On every any judicial notice where you're going into court, fighting the battle of jurisdiction is the battle. It's not just a battle. It's the battle. If you can address jurisdiction kindly, considerately, with due respect, and so that the judge smiles while you're doing it, then you may be doing something correct. And if you can do it so that the judge, you win the judge over, and or the prosecutor, either one or both, then there's a good chance that you'll win your case. There's a good chance they'll dismiss it before it goes to the jury deliberations. But the worst case scenario, if you can explain jurisdiction in third grade English so that every juror in that box understands it, then you will have done something significant. The thing that's very important about GW's issue is that the one that he's trying to help most of you with presently is that we are clarifying jurisdiction. Now, if you have a ticket to ride the Ferris wheel, but you get up there to ride the Ferris wheel and you can't explain what happened to the ticket or where it's at and you can't provide it, all the knowledge in the world will not get you on that Ferris wheel. And if you have a ticket but it looks like it's damaged, or you have an IOU from the guy at the ticket box because he ran out of tickets, and he says, here's my written. And if you get to the Ferris wheel and you can't explain how and where that came to that, sometimes you may not be able to get on the Ferris wheel. So knowing as much as you can about your status is incredibly, incredibly important. Getting back to Michael, young man, you use some big words that I don't even remember using when I was in college at law. Can you explain it in simpler words to me? If I'm going to rule in your favor, I got to understand what you're talking about. And remember, there's 12 people over there that they got to understand it too. So could you explain it? Try to stay away from the big words, young man, and try to start over and explain it simply. Can you do that?
Which part, Your Honor?
Jurisdiction.
Okay. In Black's Law Dictionary, in the 4th, 5th, and 6th editions.
Explain to them what Black's Law is, please.
Well, Black's Law is a dictionary published by Westlaw, which I'm confident that the court is well aware of. I think I see over there on the side that there's a Black's Law dictionary on the bench.
How many years has it been published?
Oh, the first publishing was, I think, 1890, 1885, and it's been updated ever since.
What's the significance of Black Law, young man?
Well, it establishes definitions, along with another book called publisher called Bouvier. It's another law dictionary. It establishes
okay.
the legal terms. Establishes legal terms. So it's...
So tell me how it applies to this situation here.
Well, Your Honor, there's the matter of jurisdiction is to determine how many jurisdictions are there. And in the United States, there are three levels of jurisdiction, actually two levels of jurisdiction, one being within the several states and the other being within the federal zone or state. And all we're trying to do here, Your Honor, is to have the state that is coming against me
this defendant in error to identify which land that this alleged incident took place on. Did it occur in land of the United States, or did it occur on land of the several states? That's the first thing. And it's important because land in the several states has laws different from the land of the United States. And how could I possibly defend myself if I don't know which laws I have to look at? Secondly, personam jurisdiction. There are people of the several states, citizens of the several states, and there are citizens that are federal citizens or citizens of the United States. And likewise, there are rights and liberties and immunities from one of the citizens of the several states versus United States citizens. They only have privileges. So I need to establish and understand what this state views me as when they come against me. If I don't have rights to travel, then you're going to force me to have a driver's license if I were a federal citizen. So we have to establish jurisdiction, Your Honor. And I gave you the court cases earlier with regards to basically the court being compelled to compel the state to establish it upon the record. That's what I'm saying.
So are you saying that this court does or does not have jurisdiction?
I'm saying until both parties, and I don't have the case in front of me, I'll have it next time. The case in front of you, sir, requires both parties to agree to establish the jurisdiction. I've asked the state to establish the jurisdiction on the record, and they refuse to. It's not my place to establish the record. It's their place. They're the ones that assert I have committed a crime. And if I've committed a crime, then it has to be established upon what land, so we can look at the laws of that crime upon that land as opposed to the other land, and as well if I'm even subject to that law as a man or a woman.
Hey, let's stop here for a moment, and I'd like to make some observations. Mm-hmm. When any of you are in court and you raise jurisdiction, usually you only get one bite at that apple. If you have studied and know what you're talking about, you can explain to them, Your Honor, there's a federal jurisdiction, there's a state jurisdiction here. As a regular John Q. aggregate citizen, I'm not under that jurisdiction of the state there or the federal government, the United States citizens. At this juncture, I never subscribed to you, and as evidence of that, I have some documentation here from the State Department in the form of my little identity card, my passport card, that says that it establishes what my citizenship is, and it defines it exactly, not what somebody's presupposing, what a prosecutor might be presupposing, but it's establishing what it is. I wish I could explain to you all the details in the case law. Wait a minute. Maybe I can. Your Honor, I'm going to take time out. I'm going to make a motion for a 4-year continuance while I go to school for law. Oops. That's not going to fly. What happens is that I wish I could say that I was the most literate individual that it's ever been in a courtroom, and that I can speak to it all A, B, C. That's not true. I haven't met very many people that are glib and can and succinct on this particular topic enough that they can persuade it very quickly. However, if we have some other branch of government, like the State Department, testifying to the value of the information that they hold on you and your position, the courts are compelled to accept that information because those cards come in the form of, whether you realize it or not, it's equivalent of an apostille or a certification with that, what the State Department provides you. And if they run the if they run your little card and the mag stripe down the back, etc., establishes your condition, the court, that's something that is to date uncontested. Well, excuse me, not successfully contested to date. So, at, out of all the direction you can go, Mike and I can take the time to educate you and GW as to all the law and everything that you might have to share in a courtroom. At this juncture, may I humbly submit that starting out a leg up with making certain that you have somebody like the State Department already affine your situation and your condition, may help resolve a lot of challenges. And even though you weren't able to get to all that nightstand reading last night, it may, you know, you may be going over it for quite a while to come, but this, but having your status correctly identified with the State Department that the whole rest of the government listens to, I'll just suggest that it may have some teeny-weeny value. Michael.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's all well and good. In fact, I do have my State Department ID with me and the card. I showed that to the prosecutor, which they kind of rolled their eyes at. Your Honor, I have a question, please. Is it a maxim of law that once that one asserts a thing, if the thing asserted is challenged, that the one making the assertion must evidence their assertion? Otherwise, not doing so, it's a nullity. Is that a maxim in law, Your Honor?
Yes, it is. If someone asserts that something is law and the individual does not contest it, then it stands.
Okay, well, Your Honor, in the very beginning, and here's a list of all the letters, here's a stack of them right here that I've written the prosecutor where I have challenged and their assertion as to the personam jurisdiction and the territorial jurisdiction upon which this alleged offense took place. They have yet to evidence their assertion. And until they evidence their assertion, there is no way that I can mount a proper defense, because there's no way I can know the law which they're applying. You don't bring a basketball to a football game.
We're going to stop here for a moment and pause. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael made a very, very astute point there. Your Honor, I have questioned this. I have objected to this. There's pleadings on file. There's my verbal objections in court. There's the letters that were sent to the prosecutor. There were the motions that were sent to the court that the prosecutor was duly served with that questioned the jurisdiction and asked them to establish it. However, there has been no establishment of jurisdiction at this juncture. How can we know what set of laws apply? Now, if you're going to ask which set of laws apply, you have to know what the difference is between the two sets of laws. So be prepared to answer that. Now, back to you, Michael. Young man, what do you mean which set of laws apply? Can you tell me which two sets we're talking about? You're saying there's two or more sets? Which ones are you talking about? I want to know. I don't know. I'm the judge. You're supposed to, you know, you're claiming there's two sets. I haven't heard this before.
Your
Honor,
Your Honor, I'm concerned that you have the power to wield the gavel, and you do not understand basic American jurisprudence. I'm asking you to recuse yourself, and let's bring a judge in here that does understand basic law.
No, I'm not going to recuse myself. If you say there's 30 stars in the universe. And I haven't heard that before. I want you to prove there's 30 stars. And if you say there's two sets of rules, I want you to prove there's two sets of rules. And I want you to explain it to me. Because if there is, then I've got to get somebody else in here. And I may have to recuse myself. But just on your statement, which at this juncture is hearsay, you haven't entered testimony and evidence into the record to support that. I'm sorry. I'm not going to recuse myself. In fact, I may just find you in contempt. You'll sit in my marshal's jail till I decide I'm good and ready to listen to your story again.
You know my wife, don't you?
Oh, buttons. Who can push
buttons? Let me help you out here, Your Honor. In U.S. versus Slater, it says, unless the defendant can prove he is not a citizen of the United States, the IRS has a right to inquire and determine a tax liability. In Houston versus Moore, it says every citizen of a state owes a double allegiance. He enjoys protections and participates in the government of both the state and the United States. In Moore versus Illinois, it says every citizen of the United States is also a citizen of a state or a territory. He may be said to owe allegiance to two sovereigns and may be liable to punishment for an infraction of the laws of either. In Cruikshank, it says it is a natural consequence of a citizenship which owes allegiance to two sovereignties and claims protection from both. So the question is, Your Honor, through these three different court cases, it clearly establishes that there are state laws and there are federal laws or United States laws. And there are state citizens and there are federal citizens. I have asked the state to evidence upon the record, again, which one they claim me to be.
Okay.
What more proof do you need, you require, Your Honor?
Okay. Well, young man, I'm trying to find out if you know what you're talking about. And I don't know if you fully understand what you're talking about, but you seem to be headed in the right direction.
An associate of mine once appeared, amicus curiae, before a court, and his quote was powerful. Would you like to hear the quote, Your Honor? Maybe that will assist in guiding you.
Okay.
He asked the court to approach amicus curiae, friend of the court. And he asked the court, would it please this honorable court to be made aware of something that could have negative repercussions of a substantial nature, either upon the court or the bench? Those were his words. And I believe that in that moment, in that instant matter, the court thought about what they were actually doing. And I'm asking you to do the same, to think about what you're doing. Depriving a man of his rights under color of law is treason to his office.
Yeah, you know what buttons to push, young man.
Yes, sir. I don't wish to push any buttons.
Hey,
I don't wish to push any buttons, Your Honor.
Hey, Michael's point in Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, it says the United States should guarantee to every state in the Union a Republican form of government. It's indicating that there is a difference, a substantial difference between the United States and the several states, okay? What happens is that there's many, many places, and if you go to the Bill of Rights and you in the 10th Amendment, it says the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by the states or reserved for the states, respectively, or to the people. It's indicating that there's multiple jurisdictions within the sea to shining sea, from the east coast to the west coast, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, including Hawaii and Alaska, and the other territories and held possessions, that there are multiple sets of governments. There are minimum two major, but there's actually multiple levels and sets of governments, including all the way down to your city or your parish. At this juncture, it's making it very clear. Well, Article 4, Section 4, Paragraph 1, it makes it very, very clear that the that the United States have a fiduciary responsibility to the individual, the several states. But at this juncture, the thing that's very important is that there are also different rules that apply to those individuals. And to the 10 by 10 square miles, 100 miles square, this was set aside and reserved for the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., technically, that is supposed to be its own seat, its own government, and its own jurisdiction. However, what happens is that they've tried to extend under the bankruptcy that occurred due to the 1929 fiscal difficulty that that occurred in 1933, after which the last duly elected electors, senators, left office in 1938. After that, they were saying that the corporation that was established in 1933 to do business on behalf of the bankrupt aggregate, if that were possible, that we are citizens of that corporation and not the aggregate, which they claim was bankrupt. To that end, there are multiple sets of laws and rules that apply. It's almost 10:30. We should probably stop here.
We have time for Q&A?
Yes, let's see. Oh, it's 9:23. Yeah, we have time for a little bit of Q&A for me. I hate to stop this right here. We're right in the middle of just a monumental, phenomenally important.
We can pick up where we left off from next week, if you like.
I think we can do that. I may not be able to do that the following week, but I think we can do that next week.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do that, and let's take some Q&A right now.
All right, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 to raise your hand. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center right of your monitor. You'll see a rectangle shape silhouette laying on its side. It's empty inside. Left-click into it and type away your comment or question. On the outside, you'll see a place to put your contact information, and then hit submit. I will be glad to give voice. Again, press star 2 on your keypad. You being on the call. Our first question comes from Miss Jennifer. Go ahead.
Jennifer, unmute your phone.
Sorry. After I spoke to you and John this morning, I got a letter with an appearance in pretrial conference not till October the 6th. And it's not an actual, it's a pretrial, not a trial conference. And it says a mask is required for your appearance. But I have a letter from a chiropractor that says that I can't wear a mask. And I have a conference with John on Friday, so I just thought I'd let you know that, and whether anyone could come to the court with me. It says here that you're entitled to be represented by an attorney at each stage of these proceedings. If you wish to be represented by an attorney, your attorney should accompany you as scheduled. I'm just wondering, do you think we could, is there anyone who could accompany me, or could we do a, ask the court if we can do a Zoom, because I'm not going to wear a mask?
That's a good question,
girl.
And,
bad girl.
During the CV-19, what's a good word for it? Issue. Because there really wasn't a pandemic. Global flu deaths were down with less than 18% of what the annual global flu deaths were during the CV-19 pandemic. So you have to wonder whether it was really a pandemic or not. One thing has happened, the pretrial conference, the PTC, that they're asking, this is the place where you can tactfully bring up, now, Jennifer, have you already done your status change or status correction?
I'm still waiting for GW to look it over and get it back to
me. He's approved it. I have it in the approved box.
Okay. So it's okay. When I ask that question, if I ask that question of anybody else, there's three answers. No, number one. Two, it's in process. Or three, it's complete. So yours should be it's in process, correct?
Yes.
Okay, good, good. The specific charges that they've brought up against you on that, let's chat about the pretrial conference together, and go from there. There's a, this is the place where, you actually speak with the prosecutor, and if there's a chance to win the prosecutor over to your side of a difficulty or an argument, and a case in point was, there's a gentleman, I got a call the other day from somebody, shocked the stuffing out of me. They waited hours. It was a federal building. The gentleman had a firearm on him. He entered the court building, had a card that he had gotten from me at the 1996 Republican Senatorial Convention here in Texas in Austin, or I mean it was San Antonio, and about carrying a firearm. And I finally got down there, got to see them, and I talked with the arresting officers. It turns out he didn't realize it was in the bottom of his case at the time. It was quite an accident. He had been at the range the day before, and this tiny little .22, which was unloaded, was in his case. But I asked the prosecutors there, I says, you know what, you understand the question that we're going to ask the judge. And the only reason they brought me down there is because I may happen to know the federal prosecutor or one of them here. And that person, when he says, well, I got to, you know, and she realized who we were talking about, and she called me up and I was allowed to go down there. I says, you know, you know, the question I'm going to ask, you know, is that, or he's going to ask is, where in the Constitution does it give the right to keep bear a firearm in this federal building, let alone that judge's courtroom? And she looked at me and she says, crap, John, did you have to ask me that? And, you know, and she says, you know what, take the cuffs off him. And all four federal marshals were very upset. They thought they had a righteous bust. She says, you don't understand. They can carry a firearm. And, actually here in Texas, it's rare that they even bring it, you know. I've talked to the federal marshals, the other day, and I talked them through it, and they says, well, we're glad you told us about this. And I says, because I explained to them what 18 U.S.C. 242 was before that, and that it could constitute a capital crime of them depriving somebody of their right to keep bear a firearm. And I asked the gentleman, who I only met twice previously in my life, and both times were at the, one was at the 96th Republican Senatorial Convention, the other was at the 2000. And, he sat in the Rules Committee, just three places to my left on the other side of Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst back then. And, of all things, Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst took two boxes of 1,000 each of those little cards and handed them out that have the 18 U.S.C. 242 on one side and on the other side, where in the Constitution it's good to write the bear firearm in this place, let alone your courtroom. That question's on the other side. Just, my son, that at the 96th convention, my son and the 2000 convention, my 6-year-old son helped hand out 11,000 of those cards. But the point is that the, this is the place where we ask academic questions that are thought-provoking, where we seek to win the prosecutor over to understand what is correct. If we walk in there, you know, and try to tell somebody you're wrong, this wrong, that wrong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, they're going to get defensive and take offense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, and that's not going to go over very well. But if, it, you know, and it's going to be us against them. But if you stand beside them and say, hey, look at that over there. What do you think? Where in the Constitution does it say this is wrong? If my status is this and this applies, and this traffic ticket, this infraction, can this be prosecuted against me? So, you know, this is the place where we ask those thought-provoking, probing questions and seek to win the prosecutor over. And never look at a PTC as, oh, no, they couldn't have the giant fly swatter is going to get me. No. Look at this as your opportunity to have a chance to work with the prosecutor and win them over on something that needs to be corrected for all the citizens. That's the way I look at it.
I mean, I think I need to write a letter and tell them that I'm not going to wear a mask somehow in a way that won't offend them. And
Jennifer, yes,
yeah,
absolutely. We're gonna write a letter and just say, hey, I have a medical issue. I have a letter from a medical professional. Can we do our PTC via Zoom or a phone interaction due to my medical condition? And presently, they are allowing that. they'll schedule a special time for you. It won't be during the normal time that they do their PTCs. But they'll schedule a a unique time for you. And yes, if you're Zoom capable, they will do that.
Okay. And would you be able to join me as my judiciary, or I don't know what I would call you, but, you know,
attorney. You're a foreigner. You speak a foreign language. You don't understand all these big words. This guy, he explains the words to me so well, you know, and I just, you know, I don't understand all this, but I don't think I need a lawyer, but just somebody that can explain, that's heard the words before and can explain it to me. And this guy does it good. Is it okay if I have him on there? Yeah.
Okay.
They usually will allow that.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you. And anyway, yeah, we'll talk about that on Friday. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Next person, Michael.
Well, let's check over in Freedom's Radio. Chef Juan writes in, please review why it's important to correct your status in order to own land. How would one go about making certain that the land is owned and or included when you purchase a home? If just purchasing a piece of land after your status has been corrected, what language is in the contract would reflect true ownership of the land?
Well, the
can I take the first part?
Go ahead.
Why is it important to correct your status in order to own land? Can a slave own land? Answer, no. And until you correct your status in law, you are a slave. Period. So you can't own land. You can't have land.
May I jump in on that one? Or you're documented as a slave, whether you are or are not. The documentation.
Correct. I can correct it. I like that better. Thank you. You're documented as a slave.
Okay. The other issue there, if you're gonna, there's multiple documentation types of documentation on land. There's grant deed, warranty deed, trust deed. There's terms like fee simple and allodial title. Now, or title in allodium. When you purchase a piece of land, if it's federal lands, technically you're only purchasing the right to use the land. It's like when you buy an automobile, the title, most people, the MSO, the manufacturer statement of origin, usually ends up going to the state. And the reason why you have to have a license is because, you just remanded your vehicle to the state. Now, if you, like when you buy a brand new car, if you say, I'm going to need the manufacturer statement of origin here on this, the MSO. About a third of the salesmen will look at you kind of funny and cockeyed, and they'll say, I need to ask somebody I don't know what you're talking about. I need to ask somebody about that. You know, and you can try to explain to them, but they're not going to listen to you. They're going to listen to somebody that's paying their truck. And then they'll come back and they'll say, yeah, we can get that. It's going to take a little bit. And you just tell them, yeah, I'll buy the vehicle, but I need the MSO. And with a manufacturer statement of origin, technically you don't have to register that vehicle. Over the years, I've had quite a few vehicles that I may have had more than one that haven't been registered, or I put a plate on there like it says Sovereign on it. And there's a Suburban parked outside that has it just says SOV on it, the sort of Sovereign. But, and I get cops that like to pull over and ask about it. And I, you know, and they ask why I don't have a Texas driver's license. And I've responded, you know, as well, that's a good question. Did you want an answer? I don't tell them. I ask them, and I ask them for permission to explain it to them. you know, would you like an answer? Oh, yeah. Well, it says, well, a license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, correct? Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then I have them look up 18 U.S.C. 242. And while some people misuse that and turn and beat people over the head with it, I try to be tactful about it. You know, and I, you know, they look it up on their phone, anyone deprived somebody of the civil rights of the color of law, et cetera. You know, and so it's actually a short statute. It takes them usually less than 20 or 30 seconds to read it. Then I say, yeah, now, if I don't have a license, does that mean that I can't go to work, drive my car to work on Monday or church on Sunday or shopping Wednesday night? Or if my son cuts his foot on a glass bottle that I can't take him to the hospital to save his life, would that be a deprivation of civil rights under color of law? And I just ask him, you know, I don't tell him, you know, and you, so-and-so, this is a deprivation. The first thing he's going to get you is a free gift bracelet, you know, if you take that approach. But I ask him, you know, I just scratch my head and says, well, what do you think? You know, and I ask them for their honest opinion. And invariably, they always, you know, they always agree. Every single time. I've had a couple of officers, they said, I had one that he even said, Mr. Gallick, is it okay if I write you a ticket? And, I said, sure. He said, why are you so, I says, I'll just go explain to the judge, you know, and this one officer, he says, I want to be there for that. You know, and we got there and the judge says, State versus John here. And, no Texas driver's license. And, he says, how do you plead? I says, well, I have a question, Your Honor. He says, no, this isn't arraignment. This is, guilty, not guilty, nulla contendere. You know, and I just sat there, you know, I smiled at the judge and I says, you know, and she says, what's the matter? I says, well, I don't understand why I'm here. You know, she says, what do you mean you don't understand? She says, well, I don't understand why I got this ticket. I have a question. She says, look, guilty, not guilty, no condemn. You know, and after about almost a minute and a half of this, she says, okay, what's your question? I says, at this particular case, a license and permission to use something is otherwise illegal, correct? And she says, of course. And one of the two prosecutors jumped up, and there was a male and a female, and the female jumped up, and she says, okay, yeah, it's some, you know, but, you know, get on with this, Your Honor. I object to this. This is, and the judge says, look, I asked him the question. He's answering my question. Could you please be quiet? You know, and she had the prosecutor sit down, you know. And I says, hey, Your Honor, and I says, so, I'd like to just enter into the record judicial notice for 18 U.S.C. 242. Would that be okay, Your Honor? She says, what is that? And before I can start to explain, the clerk says, I've got it pulled up right here. I'm printing it on your printer, Your Honor. And it spit out right up on her desk, right up on the bench. And there's about 300 people in the courtroom at the time. And what happens is that she read it out loud. Anyone deprived somebody, sir? I says, Your Honor, so if I don't have this license, does that mean I can't go to work on Monday, drive to work, or go to church on Sunday, or go shopping on Wednesday night, or if my son cuts his foot on a glass bottle, I can't take him to the emergency room to save his life? And she started to, she looked at me, and she leaned back in her chair, almost fell over. She, and says, is there anything else you want to say? She says, well, I says, just Your Honor, would that be considered a deprivation of civil rights under the color of law? And she started to laugh. And she says, you know what, young man, I see exactly where you're going. I'm probably 20 years older than this judge, you know. And she called me young man, you know, and I'm at least 15 years older. She says, I'm going to summarily dismiss your ticket here, you know. And both prosecutors object, Your Honor, but says, what do you drive on? What do you, and the officer spoke up there and he says, She's got an IMQ. She says, do you have an IMQ? I says, yeah. He says, I've heard about it, but I've never seen one. Can I see it? And the judge is saying this. I gave it to the bailiff and gave it up there. And, you know, and she says, hey, everybody, look at this. This is really, and I says, and, I was scratching my head, and you gotta note that I'm in a wheelchair. And, and she says, what's wrong? You know, and she goes, I says, so does that mean that anybody else that was cited for no Texas driver's license that you're going to summarily dismiss theirs also? And she goes, you're really trying things, young man. You're trying my patience. Just a question, Your Honor. I just, you know, with all due respect to the court. And she goes, okay, by a show of hands, how many of you have no Texas driver's license on your ticket? There's almost 300 people in this courtroom. Over half of them stood up. You know, and she says, by a show of hands, and they sat back down. She says, okay, now you keep your hands up. Now, those of you, it's the only charge on your ticket. And those of you stand up. And about half of them stood up. And she says, okay, those of you, it's the only charge, come over here to this, to my clerk on this side. And those of you who have other charges, come over here. We're just going to summarily dismiss them. But those of you who have other charges, you're not getting those dismissed. And she looks down at me and kind of smirks and says, are you happy now? And I just smile and says, thank you, Your Honor. And she says, we're going to take a 15-minute recess. And one of the clerks says, Your Honor, this is going to take a half hour to 45 minutes minimum to process. We've got probably 100, 150 people to process. And she goes, take it a 45-minute recess. She unsnapped her gown, left it draped over the chair, stepped down, and came down and sat on the prosecutor's table to talk to me. And she says, were you going to quote anything else? I says, you mean Smith versus State, 1990, and Meyer versus State, 91? And she started laughing, and she says, here you guys, here it is. Those are the two states in this state that there's no driver's license required unless you're operating a commercial, you know. And she says, you know, I knew there was something I liked about you. And she, okay, 2 weeks, almost 2 weeks to the day later, I was in the parking lot, and the bailiff and one of the clerks were crossing the parking lot from her court. And they stopped me. They said, hey, Jay, wait. And they both said that one of them said that he'd been in her court for 21 years, the bailiff. He says he's never seen her smile, let alone laugh. He says, do you realize she hasn't prosecuted a single ticket for no Texas driver's license since you were in her courtroom? And she asked them right up front, and she says, hey, come up here, we're going to dismiss that. And the officers have quit writing that. Okay? If you know the truth will set you free. The title on your land is something that you need to know the truth about. Were certain things spirited away when it was handled through the BLM or as a government land? Is it part of an original land grant where it makes the owner of the property the highest taxing authority? And then you have to prove whether, if that was the original land grant, did someone along the way decide, you know what, I want to do something benevolent, and we're going to establish a city here, and I'm going to give the city the authority to tax from the land to run in a benevolent capacity for the residents, and we're going to set up so that schools can be funded, et cetera, and they pay school tax or whatever. But you have to check these things and verify that when you go in there to buy a piece of property, that not just that the property is capable of giving you what you want, but that technically as Mr. Edwards pointed out, a slave cannot own land. You must technically be an aggregate person. Some people like to use the word sovereign. I've gotten burned out on that. It does apply. But you have to be capable of owning that land. And if the land is capable of being owned by a sovereign, then having your status corrected. In Arizona, in Maricopa County, in 1997, there were two separate lawsuits where individuals, they claimed rights. They thought they had traced the title in allodium to the original Spanish land grant for that property, which did give the individuals the right to be the highest taxing authority, but that it had been given away by the individual that established the township where both these properties lived. One was in 97, one was in 98. Both individuals were not just prosecuted for failure to pay the taxes. The land was taken away from them, and they were also given jail time. So knowing the truth so that you know what the land is capable of, and you being capable of accepting and receiving the land, is extremely important. Michael.
I was muted. Pardon me. Yes, sir.
Do we have any more? Or my time has just about come to a close.
All right, let me just refresh here one second. I don't want to impose on you. No, we're going to go ahead and stop here tonight and return next week for the other half of your story. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. You've done a terrific outcome tonight. We've got a great number of people tonight. Return, if you would, this Saturday for Judge Bernie, where he will show you how to protect your assets, where you get to a place where you own nothing, but you control everything. And then rejoin us again Monday when GW will share with you more on correcting your status. And until then, I want to thank everybody. I want to thank John very much, very kindly for stepping in tonight. And he will be here next week, but the following week his schedule is tentative at best. So until next week, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.